drawing room over here.
Oh, hey, come on in.
Plagues are as certain as death and taxes. That's a quote from the British Medical Journal from 2003. But do they need to be? Is there the technology and the will to prevent a serious outbreak? Dr. Jonathan Dequick is a senior fellow at Management Sciences for Health, a global health non-profit. Before that, he was the CEO and he has worked at the World Health Organization. And his new book is a call to action, inspired by fear and anger at what he's seen, but also by hope. It's called The End of Epidemics, and he's my guest in the drawing room. Jonathan, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You were part of the efforts against Ebola back in 2014. That must have been a very, very stressful time.
Well, it was. It felt a fear I'd never felt before. In healthcare, you usually are not worried about your patients killing you, as it were. But what we saw with the health workers there and with everybody was just a real sense of panic at first. And it's a horrific disease.
Before 2014, the conventional wisdom about Ebola is that it was a dead-end event. Why was that the assumption, and why was it so wrong?
Well, yes, there were two pieces of conventional wisdom that West Africa received from the experts, as it were. One was that Ebola wasn't in West Africa, and actually it had been and been documented there over decades. The other was, as you say, a so-called dead-end event. That is, it would burn out so quickly, kill so quickly, that it would end itself. No one ever imagined that it would get into urban areas, when the big difference in West Africa was that it was an urban disease. And that could have been anticipated, but it wasn't.
You said that you hadn't been that worried about your patients killing you before like that. And that's, I mean, it just really struck me. It's such a strong comment. And this was because it wasn't just a health threat. There was a lack of trust from the community, wasn't there?
Well, indeed. And one of the dynamics of any epidemic is fear. It's fear of the other, fear of the unknown, and it's rumor. There were 8 health workers and journalists that went into a village in Guinea to provide education about the problem, and they were slaughtered and thrown in the school cistern. So that kind of reaction happens when people don't understand the epidemic and are fearful of their lives.
Given that fear, that dynamic that you're talking about there, how do you create an effective multinational response to an epidemic? How do you make things better and remove that lack of trust and that overwhelming fear and distrust and the sort of feeling of crisis, I suppose?
Well, the foundation actually is in countries and at the community level. And it's a preparedness. It's part of what you need to have is community health workers and schools that are educating people even before the pandemic hits. When you've got a trusted local educated population, then they can get the message out. The message that's gotten to the West about Ebola in West Africa was that health systems were a mess, the countries were a problem, it was totally out of control, and it took the international community to come in and fix it. Good part of which was true, but the success story that is not told is how it ended. And that happened, and we'll take Sierra Leone, for example, that happened when we mobilized, we being the collective country and international response, we mobilized the 4,000 market women, the 20,000 traditional healers, the religious leaders, the local media. Once you had the local population hearing the message from people they trusted, we saw a rapid decline in Ebola and ultimately the end of it in those countries, the end of that epidemic. It still lingers.
Yeah, of course. So what are the important lessons that you took out of the Ebola epidemic? Is it that you need to engage beyond the healthcare system?
Yes, that's one lesson. I mean, the first lesson is that we need to invest in collectively in making sure that communities are ready. The second is that you have to have leadership all the way up the line. at the international level, there was a period of just delay and not responding and not having confidence in the messages from below. So it's as much a medical and public health preparedness as it is being ready to, at the leadership level, to take action quickly, understand the situation, and move.
In this book, you say that you wrote it not just because you're scared, but because you're furious. Is that because of the delay you're talking about there?
Yes, there is this pattern of panic and neglect that we see with epidemics. If we go back to smallpox, which was a horrific disease, killed 500 million people in the last century, we had eliminated it in Europe and North America by 1950. In 1951, the head of the World Health Organization said, let's eliminate it worldwide. It took 15 years, three big meetings of the world's health leaders before they made the decision to do it. During that time, 30 to 40 million people died with smallpox. Once they decided to move, it took a decade. So it's really a matter of acting ahead of time and being on top of these epidemics and not hanging in complacency. That we're safe, so everyone's safe, which isn't true.
Before we get to the hopeful part of the interview, and I promise our listeners there is lots of hope still, I want to get into what makes you concerned still, because you're very concerned, and a few of the biggest issues you mention aren't around medicine or science or government, but actually about food. You say that bushmeat and the inequality that makes that a food source is a major issue. Can you explain that to me?
Well, we continue in parts of Africa and other parts of the world to eat what we call bushmeat. It's basically wild animals. And Asia suffered in 2003 with the SARS epidemic, severe acute respiratory distress, which really knocked the economies in the region and cut flights in half. And this was a delicacy animal, the civet, that got this new virus, the first new virus of the 21st century, got into a hotel in Hong Kong, within literally a matter of weeks, got to 27 countries. And so this is how viruses spread from literally the bush, from animals into humans, and it can happen anywhere.
If you're just tuning in, this is RN. I'm Patricia Carvelison. Dr. Jonathan Quick is my guest in the drawing room, and we're discussing his new book, The End of Epidemics. So what's wrong with the way that we do manage livestock? I mean, why is this such a big issue?
The livestock business, so if we look at beef, they're actually doing pretty well right now. We had a man-made epidemic of mad cow disease out of UK. Chicken, particularly chickens and swine, pigs, they're the incubators. They're part of the cycle of developing new flu vaccines. We think of flu as the common cold, but if anything is going to wipe out 200 to 400 million people in the matter of a couple of years, it's going to be flu. So there, we need, particularly with poultry and with swine, we really need to be vigilant about the conditions under which they are produced. We have a virus now, a flu virus that's known in China. It's one of the bird flus, H7N9. And China's not telling the rest of the world the specifics of that virus. And that's a problem. But that probably is something that came out of chickens. As part of a overall wild bird, waterfowl, chicken mechanism that distributes the virus around the world.
How much of a concern, if at all, is the idea of human-created epidemics, of bioterrorism or a mistake at a lab? Am I just kind of stuck in, you know, Hollywood fiction here, or is that something that you factor into your plans?
No, that's a serious concern. If we just take, for example, North Korea, we talk a lot about nuclear weapons, and rightly so, but their biological labs, according to the Defense Department of South Korea and others who've looked at, have the intelligence. They've got at least a dozen pathogens, including smallpox. There's no evidence they've tried to weaponize it, But if they decided to, they could, and that would be horrific. Just 10 days ago, the University of New South Wales did a simulation exercise, which is an important way of thinking about pandemics and planning around the possibility of a smallpox outbreak. So those sorts of things are real concerns for which we need to be thinking ahead.
What happens to the healthcare infrastructure of a country during an epidemic? How much of an issue is the direct disease or virus, and how much is a system being overwhelmed?
Well, a bit like war, where there's more deaths from illness and disrupted healthcare and health infrastructure than war wounds often, it's the same with a pandemic. In West Africa, we saw women literally delivering in the streets because they weren't going to the facilities. We saw the immunization rates go down. We saw malaria coverage go down. And so it's disruption of routine health care. And it doesn't only happen there. I mean, we had last year in the U.S. with the flu epidemic, we had hospitals that set up literally casualty mash tents in their parking lots because of patient overflow.
So what I promised our listeners we'd go here, so let's do it. Let's look at some of the positives. You're right that we need to reimagine what is possible. What do you mean by that, and why do we need to do this?
Well, we've had a number of examples of where people said something was impossible. It was impossible to eradicate smallpox, and we did. In the year 2000, when only 1% of people who needed AIDS medicines had it, we said that was impossible. We've got 17 million on treatment today. The director of the Center for Disease Control stood in Hong Kong in the middle of the SARS outbreak and said, I don't think SARS will ever be eliminated, and it was. So what we need to do is to really imagine making the world substantially safer against these pandemic threats. Scientists and public health people know what's needed. We just need to move faster with the right resources and the leadership.
You point to the need for active prevention. Does that mean vaccines, or is it broader than that?
So it's first of all, personal healthcare habits. With common airborne diseases like flu, good hand washing, staying out of work or school when you're sick, and those kind of things, they actually work. Yeah, it's vaccines too. And vaccines are a really critical part of epidemic response. We're saving tens of millions of lives with with vaccines. And we're right now fighting a little bit of a challenge with the anti-vaccination folks, but vaccines are a critical part of prevention.
So how do we create trust then? We've seen things like vaccine skepticism and the paranoia around Ebola in the US. There is clearly a lack of trust in the health industry. How do you restore it or build it or change that?
Well, I think it's a steady process by giving clear, balanced messages. It's a process of actually sitting down with the people who have questions, respect those questions, respect the skepticism. No field is perfect, so when something does go amiss, really own up to it quickly and get that message out. Building the chain of trust is really understanding and listening to where people are coming from and sharing the facts and bringing everyone into the picture.
A lot of what you've talked about here and in the book involved an international response and an understanding that these are global issues, that, you know, there's no sort of national boundary that can stop this. That's not the way the world works. Does it concern you that a lot of countries in the world seem to be, you know, looking inward increasingly?
Yes, absolutely. I think that you can't build a wall tall enough to keep out pathogens, to keep out deadly viruses. And we're very vulnerable economically and in terms of just daily life, given how interrelated we are. If you look at the imports, the exports, the movement of goods that you need for daily life, you've got to work to be safe everywhere. And it's a fantasy to think that you're going to be, that you can make yourself safe at home without helping others to be safe in their homes.
So what are the key investments that you think need to be made to prevent epidemics?
Well, the first investment is to confront the reality that less than one out of three countries, less than one out of two countries worldwide, easily half the countries, don't have the ability right now to prevent, detect, and respond to disease outbreaks. We have a very, very clear definition. There's no ambiguity what needs to happen. And there's really good movement with a scorecard approach to knowing countries where they are. And so that's number one, is helping other countries to build their defenses. The second thing is to invest in new vaccines. We have now a lot going on with a universal flu vaccine, with vaccines for some of the viruses for which we haven't had defenses. Early detection mechanisms, there's some very good things going on there. And finally, be sure that we really work to get our leaders informed. It's an informed public, informed professionals, and informed political leaders. Because you can't wait until you're in the middle of an outbreak, a middle of a major pandemic, to start educating the president about, or the prime minister about these risks. So there has to be that level. So investment in systems, investment in innovation and leadership.
Jonathan, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Patricia.
Dr. Jonathan Quick has been my guest in the drawing room. His new book is called The End of Epidemics, and he's appearing this weekend at the Brisbane Writers Festival. That's it for the show tonight. I'll be back tomorrow at 6 p.m., but you can listen to all of our interviews anytime you like. Anytime. 3 a.m., 9 a.m., whatever you like. On the ABC Listen app or the RN website is how you find us. We're just called RN Drive. Coming up next, it's Australia-wide. Have a great night.